No, it's all way too close. Okay. All right. I apologize, everybody. Ellen won't be able to join us, but Dolores, as our vice chair, is going to do it. And then Tyler also won't be here. So, yeah, she won't be able to join us. Prior engagement.
Okay. Well, today is November the 5th, 2025, regular special City of Emeryville Housing Committee meeting. This meeting is called to order at 6:14 p.m. The meeting is being audio and video recorded. Staff will take roll at this time.
Okay. Chair Frost, she is absent. And Vice Chair Johnson?
Absent.
And Member Drummond?
Present.
Member Hill is also absent. Member Jessup?
Here.
Member Nadiros?
Here.
Member Oakley?
Here.
We do have a quorum.
All right. Now is the time for public comments. Each member will have 2 minutes. Anyone who wishes to make comments related to items not on the agenda should raise their hand and identify their name for the record once called upon.
Does anybody in the public
who
wants to make a comment?
Moving on. Ask the secretary if there are any comments received online.
No online comments.
Okay, agenda items.
I did have on the agenda real quick the approval of, for whatever reason, we missed the April 2nd minutes getting those approved. So those are provided. Even those who are not here, you can provide a vote if you want to. It has been determined it's okay that you weren't there. If we don't have enough people who do want to provide a vote, that's fine. We'll submit them without being approved. And then for whatever reason, I left my minutes for the last meeting at home. I didn't have them with me today. So we will have to do those at the December meeting when we do this meeting as well. So all I have for today is the April one.
Are you guys voting to accept the agenda for April?
Motion to accept the minutes.
Second. Okay, our agenda for April.
We take the vote. Vice Chair Johnson?
Yes.
Member Brooke Jeffup?
Yes.
Member Medeiros?
Yes.
Member Oakley?
Yes.
And Member Drummond? Yes.
Voting. I didn't read it, but I would say yes if you guys are
so
exactly.
You can abstain.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I'd like to read it.
Okay.
But yeah, you can still.
Yeah, that's fine. Okay. We can do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that still works. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's it. Okay. Now we're back to the agenda for today, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So now we're
number five, action items.
We don't have any for this evening.
Number six, information items. Okay. 6.1, rental preservation rehab program outline.
Okay, so item 6.1, this is our rental preservation rehab program outline. Can you hear me? Okay, I'm assuming that's going to record it. So this program will be a low interest rate loan for a multi-unit rental housing developments here in Emeryville. It'll help owners support building renovations that are needed for the property. We currently have about a little over $8 million within our Measure C housing bond, which does include a little over $4 million that's set aside specifically for special needs units. So those will be the funds that'll be available to support this program. Special needs targeting population would be projects that would target elderly, which is not seniors. Seniors is 55 and up, elderly is 65, I think. Disabled, transitional age youth, people living with HIV or AIDS, or people experiencing homelessness. They would be eligible for that $4 million set aside. Eligible applicants will be private entities, nonprofit organizations, or a limited liability company who owns a multi-unit rental project here in Emeryville. Eligible properties would include non-below market rate properties that have five or more units, and that would be our first priority, or We could also fund below market rate properties that have 5 or more units. That would be our second priority. The requirements for the program, all projects that submit an application would have to have a physical needs assessment or a capital needs assessment. They're very similar reports, but they are slightly different. The physical needs assessment assesses the current physical conditions of a property and identifies necessary repairs and replacements, whereas the capital needs assessment is really doing an inspection of the property and identifying the useful life of items and identifying what the cost would be to correct those items based off when the useful life ends. It's usually divided into property maintenance issues and critical repairs, so they'll also kind of tier items there. Eligible activities do include improvements to major building systems, repairs to the property that can include the building code or health and safety code conditions, upgrades to increase the energy efficiency of the property. There could be other capital project based expenses that are needed that would improve the life of the building overall or an occupant's need. Soft costs, we could also do conversion of an existing commercial or common area space into an accessory dwelling unit. We could fund that. If there's a requirement for any temporary relocation, potentially that could be funded from the program. And then, of course, we could cover construction management fees. However, all work that would be funded with these funds has to be something that was identified either in that physical needs assessment report or in the capital needs assessment report. We are not just doing upgrades to a property just because the project wants one. It has to be some type of critical repair need or something that's outside its useful life. Loan terms right now we're proposing, and this will be something that we'll talk about a little bit tonight, is there'll be a maximum loan of $2 million per project. We would do a 3% simple interest rate, 15 to 20 year term. Repayments may be deferred based on the project's financial feasibility, or potentially we could forgive the project at the end of the affordability period. The loan amount will be capped at actual cost and eligible activities. So if their project is $3 million, they're still only going to get two. If they think their project is $2 million, and as the project goes along, they actually only spend $1.75, then we would reduce the loan, and that's what they would receive it. There is a 15% contingency required. We do have the ability. So let's say that their cost actually went to 1.75. There's funding still remaining in contingency. That contingency funds can be drawn down and deposited into their replacement reserve account so that they can address other capital needs in the future. Project applicants would have to sign a deed of trust as promissory note, and then of course execute a regulatory agreement related to the income and affordability requirements. Those income and affordability requirements for a market rate or mixed income property. Right now, what we're proposing is for every $125,000 of funding they received, one unit would have to be rent restricted and income restricted for households at 80% of AMI. And then potentially, if they were willing to have units restricted at 50%, then potentially they could get up to $250,000 per unit. Restricted units must be a representative of the types of units in the project. So we are not going to allow them to restrict just studios. If they have a mix of units within their development, they'll have to do a proportional share. And then, of course, it will always be a requirement that there's an annual report that's submitted to the city on the rent, income, and occupancy status of that project. Other project requirements would include that they have to maintain property insurance, and identify the city as a lost payee during the term of the loan. They'll be responsible for procuring their own construction contractor. That contractor does have to have a general contractor's license. They have to have an Emeryville business license. They have to have liability and workman comp insurance. And then they'll have to comply with the city's prevailing wage requirements. The evaluation criteria that we're proposing to use is the qualification of the applicant's team, the impact of the proposed rehabilitation on the longevity of the building and the daily life of the tenants, that the rehab work is consistent with the physical needs assessment or the capital needs assessment, whether or not they did any engagement or have support of their tenants in doing the renovation work, and whether or not they were able to leverage any funds. So the questions that I do have here for you guys for just consideration and discussion, because this is just an outline, I'm still working out all the details, is should our program design include a pre-development loan fund for properties to access capital to facilitate a current physical needs assessment or capital needs assessment report. So this would be, you know, we want to have one, but usually you want one that's not stale dated. So do we want to provide the ability for projects to be able to access funding to pay for that assessment? And maybe this year they're not able to apply for funding, but in a future round they would, because now they would have a current report. That's something that we should consider incorporating into the project.
How much do those reports usually cost?
I don't know here in Pottsville.
Okay.
It is a good question.
It's significant, presumably.
I mean, it could be several thousand dollars. Yeah, that it would cost. Yeah. I don't know that it would cost more than $10,000, but I don't have an estimation of the market here because things are much more expensive than I'm familiar with. But potentially, you know, that could be somebody who may not be able to participate in the program because they don't have one. That could give them an opportunity to access capital in order to pay for it.
Could you just like one more time explain that?
The capital needs assessment. So the capital needs assessment is going to do an inspection of the property. And then they're going to identify the useful life of items throughout the property. And then they're going to estimate, usually it's like a 15-year cycle. So when are things not going to be valid and when do they need to be replaced? Mm-hmm. And then they'll estimate out what that cost is. And so then it provides you like with a identification of in year one, this is how much money you need to address these items that are going to no longer be in their useful life. And it goes all the way through 15 years. Mm-hmm. It'll also identify if there is deferred maintenance or things that are critical that need to be repaired. So that's what the capital needs assessment. The physical needs assessment will just kind of go through and inspect the property and identify all the deferred maintenance. It doesn't provide you with that cost assessment necessarily, but it does identify everything that's currently not in a condition that would be feasible or something that needs to be repaired. And so that's just the difference. So they could have either, I've seen projects submit both reports. We would accept either one of them.
That's a clarifying question about program, because when I was reading over it and talking about the health and safety code,
mm-hmm.
I was wondering, like, why does the city want to step in to cover those costs if it should be the property's responsibility to maintain habitability and safety? Like what's
the reason for it?
Yeah,
what's the benefit? The issue is, especially when you're dealing with affordable properties, they're not bringing in enough revenue in order to maintain all of the things that would need to be replaced over the life of the project. And so you traditionally find that with a lot of HUD-assisted properties, but affordable properties, because they're restricted on what they can collect in rent, they're using that revenue to pay all their operating bills, and then they're hopefully saving some money to the side to address long-term maintenance issues that they'll have with the property. A lot of times, financing will identify what's required to be maintained. It never keeps up with what the actual costs are. So like maybe when they got their loan 20 years ago, it was like, oh, you need to put aside $250 per unit. Well, 20 years ago, maybe that was fine. But today the costs have just dramatically increased and it doesn't cover. My account doesn't have now enough money in there to address all those issues. And so one of our goals in the housing element is about preserving our existing housing stock and ensuring that even those who are living in older homes still are living in a place that's safe and healthy and is somewhere where they don't feel like they have to move because it doesn't have everything in it that it should, in order to make sure that you're addressing those critical needs. So that's why the city would want to come in a rehab program and try to help those older properties, especially those that are affordable. One of the things that we built into our Measure C program was the idea of not just reinvesting all of our money into projects that we've already funded, but how can we expand our portfolio of affordable housing? And part of that is about providing subsidies to projects that don't already have financing. So it might be a mixed income property that also has needs because we're still restricting their rents, but they don't have a loan from us. But they may also have some needs that they just don't have the money to address. And maybe we can get out of them for providing that funding additional affordable housing units. So that's why the program is separated into address all of our affordable housing stock, but also other properties that would be willing to accept the money with the requirement that you get the money. Now you got to give us an affordable unit.
Okay. Right. So you guys, part of the application process would be a financial assessment of their finances to ensure that it's not just like they're not, you know, just being negligent towards the low-income units versus like neglecting their responsibility to meet habitability and safety codes. Is that they actually have a need for it?
They would have, absolutely. They have to show us their replacement, how much money is in their reserve. The study is going to show how much money they need to address it. We would have also have to get an accounting of what they have in their reserve, and there would have to be a gap.
Okay.
Don't you already like have an idea of which property that would be? I mean, wouldn't you have to create that with them with certain properties in mind? Or no?
No. We don't know.
Do you know all the buildings that are affordable that are have units that are affordable housing?
I know all the buildings, but I would not know their capital needs or what deferred maintenance they have. No.
Okay.
We don't know.
That's a finite number, probably a pretty small number in Emeryville, right?
Well, I would say no. Okay. I think every single multi-unit property, whether it was rental or ownership, has deferred maintenance that they have not addressed. I think that's just kind of,
gotcha.
We just see it from everywhere. Especially on older properties. Newer ones, not so much, but on older properties, there's just some things that they don't have the ability of upgrading. And maybe they're close to being able to do it. Sometimes they have to make decisions. I'm going to do this and not that, and I'll wait. And hopefully maybe in a couple of years, I'll get more money. A lot of times that's why you'll see properties refinance to get that influx of capital to try to be able to address concerns. But no, I think most properties probably have something. The question is the severity of it. Like you may have a property that hasn't changed its carpets in 15 years. It probably is beyond the useful life, but are they going in and changing everybody's carpet just because it's beyond 15 years? No, because they don't have the money to do it.
Gotcha.
And what they're supposed to be doing is periodically figuring out how they do it. But no, we as a city would not know exactly for every single property what kind of repair needs they have unless there's a code compliance complaint. And a lot of deferred maintenance wouldn't result in a code compliance issue.
Okay. But it's not just restricted to buildings that have low income units.
No.
Okay.
No.
That's
we
what I
wanted to do.
Okay, got it. That clears it up. And then one other question. On a previous slide it said the wages. What is that?
The 80% of AMI?
No, I think it's on the next one. Prevailing wage.
Oh, the prevailing wages.
Yes, yeah, so these are to be the work is to be done. Are you not requiring unions to do the work? Or is that just on like new properties?
We don't know. There would not be a requirement for unions to do the work. We don't have a labor agreement. But what there would be requirement is that they comply with the city's prevailing wages so that the workers are being paid whatever the dollar, and right now I couldn't tell you what it is, but whatever that amount goes into our contract, and then they would have to pass that on to them, making sure that they're paying their workers who are doing the actual construction work a minimum of that salary.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I kind of wanted to piggyback on what she was saying about knowing which buildings have issues or back maintenance. Because I did see that in the point system that was reported, it does say that tenant engagement would, you know, increase or decrease the points, but it doesn't state like a requirement for tenant engagement. And so I was wondering if tenants could be engaged at the beginning stages in parallel with this application process to where they're getting to voice maybe some of their issues so that it's not just for the owner's benefit, but also actually hearing the voices of the tenants.
So this is just an outline. So I haven't flushed everything out. That's why I bring things as an information so we can have the conversation. And if there's something that we need to consider and bring in, then that's something we can do. Traditionally, we have not had applicants engage the tenants on the front end. The engagement would only come once they received their award. And so then it would be about notifying the tenants of what's going to happen, making sure that they're communicating, you know, the process and what's going to happen, what's not going to happen. That's traditionally how it's worked. If we did a requirement, and I'm not saying it can't happen, but if we require there to be engagement on the front end, that would delay when people could submit an application. Traditionally, we try to have a 4-week time frame. So like right now, the anticipation would be that this would be released in February or March. But we would have to give them more than 30 days to respond if they have to engage their tenants before they submit an application. And the only other slight concern I would have is whether or not they'd want to put in that work without knowing they're getting the money. Mm-hmm. That could be a deterrent for people not wanting to apply for the money.
I'm wondering if it could be as simple as like a survey to tenants, because if, then you could actually, it could be like measurable data. So if tenants, if you know you had a high quantity of tenants expressing that, like, oh, yeah, our carpets are really old. Oh, yeah, we have more leaking. And if we see that in the application process, not only are we having the owner advocating mm-hmm. for the health that they need, but we could measure if we measurable data, because we'll have like the inputs of how many tenants are actually voicing mm-hmm. their concerns. And I think as a tenant, I would definitely have responded to that type of survey. Mm-hmm. Because if I have maintenance things that aren't being met, I would definitely want to help our property manager get our property owner mm-hmm. to get the resources they need to meet that. Mm-hmm. So I think even if it was a full survey.
I like the idea of the survey.
Yeah, it could be measured like in a graph or anything. Mm-hmm. It could be anonymous, but or connected to the unit or, you know.
I think that that's definitely possible, that we could create a survey that they would have to release to their tenants, and then whatever data comes in, they could collect. The requirement still, however, is it has to be things that are identified in the physical needs assessment. So we wouldn't address things just because tenants say this is their issue if it's not also identified in there. But yeah, I think that's something we could definitely look at. I like that idea.
Yeah.
So when... and I'm specifically thinking of multifamily dwellings. When they have a certain number of units that meet this rehab program, how often or when I'm trying to understand, when have they created more affordable units? Because
you mean in the past?
Huh?
You mean in the past?
Yes, in the past. Yes. Yes. Like, for
we
example.
We have not.
Huh?
We have not.
Exactly. And I think that yeah, because I feel that
what we always saying, do the new. We never go back and address the existing.
Yes.
This would be our opportunity to go back and address existing properties and try to do something.
Exactly. And, but the hope is that this could help spur more affordable housing units, or
yes, that is the hope, that we could extract from them for the funding we're providing to address an issue that they have, a requirement that they add an additional affordable housing unit. Now that wouldn't work on those projects that are 100% affordable. It would only work on those that are the mixed and our primary, our below market rate portfolio. Mm-hmm. That's where it would only work, where we could get them to add an additional unit. Okay. And I actually have a question. That's a follow-up, so let me go back. I'm going to get back. So we asked the pre-development. The other question I have, and then we'll get to where I think you're going, is should funds be prioritized? Right now, that's what we're proposing, to preserve new affordable housing restricted units or to preserve existing affordable. So this is the question. We want the money just to go to our existing affordable housing projects, and they're the only ones can access it. If that's the case, we're not getting any new affordable units, but we're helping our affordable housing developments. Or do we want it to go to our mixed income projects with the requirement that they add additional affordable housing units? Right now, we have it set up where it'd be a priority. So we would prioritize the creation of new units, but still could also assist our existing projects. But it would be a tiered system.
So it's not preserve the new affordable housing restricted units, but like create. Essentially, is that right?
Yes, it would be creating new ones.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. So just because, so I like the idea of preserving, or sorry, prioritizing the ones that are currently existing, just only based off of the data that was in the pipeline, because I would have questions like if we are allotting funds for new units, like how much what is the time frame for those to become actualized? Because right now in the pipeline, it wasn't, there's a huge gap between goal and what has actually been actualized between things like it was
you're talking about item 6.5 mm-hmm. totally yeah. separate.
Okay.
Nothing on that would apply to this.
Only I will want numbers to know, like the timeline of if we were putting money towards new units, are they going to have a time frame of when those need to be produced, when they would be accessible?
So for the rental rehab, it would be about taking an existing development that exists mm-hmm. and then assigning a vacant unit to now has to be income restricted. Okay. So they're not having to construct anything new. The money could be going, let's say that they need a new elevator and they're going to take an existing vacant unit and now it's going to become affordable. And so now they're going to have to reduce the rent on that and advertise it as an affordable unit. That's how the rental rehab, the residential pipeline is about all new construction, like sticks building things out of the ground. Nothing exists today. So these units would be able to become affordable as soon as the work is complete. Assuming that there's not work happening in that unit, but as soon as the work is complete, they would be able to restrict that unit. So it would be much more immediate.
Next is great then.
Aren't there going to be two companies that are awarded this? Is it under two?
There could be multiple entities that could be awarded.
So can there be a mix of new affordable housing restricted units and existing?
Mm-hmm. Okay. There could. We want to accept applications from both, mm-hmm. but let's say that it's oversubscribed. Like I get 20, I can't fund 20 projects. I only have $1 million. We would do the ranking and then we would tier and put all the ones that would create new units, they would get a bump in their score so that mm-hmm. they would score better than the other ones. There also still is that set aside for the special needs because that money is only specifically. So those who would be willing to do the 50% of AMI units, they could potentially get more money. Mm-hmm. And let me walk through here. Okay. So this is kind of just like, I wanted to bring numbers for you. This is not exact. Okay. So let's just say on the top, we're looking at those projects that are just looking for money to give us new units at 80% of AMI. If I provided them with $500,000, they would be required to give me four affordable units, $125,000. Would be the determination of how many units you'd have to produce for me. If it was a 15-year loan, the end of 15 years, that loan would be $778,000. That's the loan amount plus 3% interest. Over that 15-year period, if we took today's fair market rent for a one-bedroom unit, compared that to what our current low income, which is our 80% of AMI unit rents for today, assuming that that same delta occurs over 15 years for those four units, at the end of 15 years, they would have received a reduction in revenue of $336,000. So I'm giving them $500,000. They're losing $336,000. If it was a 20-year loan, I'm giving them $500,000. They're going to lose at the end of 20 years $448,000. And the loan that would be due at the end of 20 years is $9,000. So this is just to try to understand, this is what I would give. This is what potentially the investment would result in. So one of the things we have to make sure of is that one, we're creating a program that people are going to want to apply for. Because I don't want to create something and then I don't get any applications. Because then now we've all spent a lot of time and the question, why is nobody looking for it? So there has to be an incentive. There has to be a reason why they'd want to do it. Again, these are really rough numbers. So let's assume that we're doing 50% of AMI units. So that'd be the bottom part. If I gave them $1 million, they would have to give me four units at 50% of AMI. That $1 million would result in a loan value of $1.5 million at the end of 15 years. They would receive a loss in revenue of $566,000 for those four units. If it was a 20-year loan, it'd be a loss in $755,000 in revenue. That's revenue that doesn't come in to help go towards replacements and capital improvements that are needed for the project. That's money that they're not going to collect any longer.
But what's the SN again? The difference between the top and the bottom is
special needs.
Special
needs. So the idea is if you're going to target a lower income, I'm going to give you more money And that lower income would have to target would be for somebody at a lower income level because of their special needs. Traditionally, it's how it works. So this is what is being proposed. Now, none of these numbers are finalized. I've put them in here just for discussion purposes. So we might have to make some more tweaks. I need to have our financial consultant look at it so she can tell me whether or not it actually is feasible. Would it be something somebody would be willing to do? A developer, would they be willing to say, yeah, I will take that loan from the city in order to do this. And it is worth it to me to get that money from you at this low cost, knowing I'm going to have a reduction in revenue and have to now, you know, restrict additional units at my property.
How low is the, what's the difference? Like, how much would they pay on a regular loan? And is none of this is any of this forgiven? Can any of that be forgiven?
We, right now, yes, it is drafted in a way that it could be. So one of the things that we're going to have to also assess is, right now it's set up as a loan. It could be a forgiven loan, that at the end of the 15 years, which may be what needs to happen to make it worthwhile, mm-hmm. maybe at the end of the 15 years, the loan is forgiven. And so they never have to pay it. So the benefit is they got this influx of cash today, knowing that they're going to have restricted rents for the next couple of years for whatever number of units based on their the loan that they got, that might make it worth it. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is that we could require some type of repayment. There's a lot of different ways we could always structure it. We try to leave it open to where we'll look at the financial feasibility of whether or not the project can pay it back. If a project can pay it back, well, we're going to want to get money back. Sometimes we'll do residual loan receipts, so it's only based off of the percentage of income that comes in, they'd have to give it to us. Sometimes it's a balloon payment. Sometimes it's an annual payment. We have all kinds of loans that we've structured on housing deals.
And so have you guys ever thought about having like a team that kind of enforces, maybe it's a code enforcement that does this, but the habitability issues to where that would be incentive enough for them to want to participate in the loan program instead of them getting fined? Or do you guys do that? Do you guys go out and find these properties that are out of safety?
So our code enforcement has only been in place some point during COVID.
Yeah.
We did not, the city did not have a code enforcement officer prior to that. The city still, while we have one, operates in a way that we respond to complaints. We don't go out and look for issues. We respond to complaints. So the only time that the code enforcement officer, and it's just one person, like housing is one person, it's just me. The only time they go out is when there's complaints that have been filed. So it's incumbent upon residents to file a complaint. Mm-hmm. And some complaints aren't code enforcement issues. A deferred maintenance may not be a code enforcement issue. Okay.
So I'm looking at the Emeryville Housing Element, goal H2, which is mm-hmm. to serve and improve the condition of the existing housing stock. Now, I think that when I originally read this, as a council member hat now, mm-hmm. That I looked at the word condition of the existing housing stock because I am familiar with as a renter, especially as a BMR renter, that at Courtyard, when we had our previous landlord, in our lease, they stated that our carpets and our appliances could be replaced every 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
With our new landlord, with Essex, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I'm just now dealing with the issue of someone who is who has been evicted from their home, and then I walk into their home and I can see that the carpet has not been replaced, the walls are needed. I mean, there's this all of this like maintenance that needs to happen, and so the need for a small landlord who may benefit from four units of a new affordable units, that sort of thing, it's very different from what's currently happening. Is that we've got not just landlords, corporate landlords, we've got mega corporate landlords mm-hmm. in Emeryville who more than likely are unfazed by any of this amount of money. And so thus, conserving and improving the condition the existing housing stock, that is at least something that they, I think, may be more interested in doing, as opposed to, for many of them, in terms of their own portfolio, they may not be interested in adding new affordable housing units. You know, they want to keep it mixed. They want to keep it, and they want to keep, you know, I mean, and so so that's why, like, I wanted to get an understanding of when in our history have we seen any complex, especially particularly multifamily. That's another thing, is if it's like someone who has like an ADU, right? But as we've seen with ADUs, none of them have been affordable, right? And so, so even like small landlords, yeah, exactly, right? And so
I can't force them.
Yeah, you can't force, exactly. And then remember the program that we had about the ADA access, right? And the doors and everything, how hard it was to find people
willing to access the money.
Exactly, right? And so so we're talking about like these, like the bigger the turtle, the slower it's going to move on opportunities like this. And so thus, when I'm thinking about, when I'm thinking about that line, that goal H2, conserve and improve the condition of the existing housing stock, I think I think what we're trying to do here is saying, we know that without these incentives, they will let that carpet be 30, 40, 60, 80 years old, or they'll keep recycling that refrigerator or that microwave or those sort of things for some of these units that are in dire need, that that's just not their incentive. And so that's why, like, I'm thinking more that improving the existing housing stock may be more, I guess, that's weird for me to be pragmatic.
I think your point is very valid. What we're trying to do is figure out what that rub is. We want to increase, but you're right, it may not be feasible. So maybe we don't require them to have additional affordable units, and then we just make it a straight loan. Like, we want to have the flexibility, which is why I wanted to have the conversation. And ultimately, I am still going to have to go out there and figure out, would anybody bite? And that's the big question. Would anybody bite? I don't know. Which is why part of the thought was, if I put out money for the physical needs assessment, guess what? Then I get copies of all. And now I do know, for anybody who's wanting to say, yeah, I'll take that, called a pre-development loan, but it most likely be a grant. Now I know if somebody's willing to take that money, and I would get a copy of that report. So now I have a better understanding. Now, does that mean that it becomes code enforcement? No. But that's a housing. Code enforcement is building. Does that mean that there's something that potentially we could go out and do more work on? Potentially, but that's also a capacity issue. You know, I only can do so much. So, but I'm trying to figure out, how do we get there to improve more of the units? And then what is that carrot? What is that stick? What is going to be amenable? When I looked at other programs across the country, you know, they're giving like $30,000 to $50,000 a unit. Oakland had a program, they were giving up to $300,000 a unit. And I was like, well, I don't think, you're right, $30,000 is not going to move the needle on any of these kind of people. Could it move the needle on, let's say, like a 10-unit complex that's in one of the residential neighborhoods?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
But you're right, the big ones aren't. So we got to figure out, what is it that would be worthwhile for them? Which is why I want to have this conversation, because this is the program we need to get moving on. We have money sitting there. I just got to figure out what it is that we can do to make people want these.
Questions. Are there any other streams of revenue that the landlord can use to fund affordable housing, new affordable housing? And because if they were going to lose their 336 or 448, mm-hmm. Is there another program that can be intertwined with this to offset that loss of cash, but it's coming from a different Soros. Entity or program that they're like, okay, I'm willing to make that trade-off because I'm losing it here, but I'm gaining all this over here. And whether it's some kind of upkeep or some like a company that would
not make, really, you know what I mean? Not really. I mean, what I have seen is on the affordable housing side, they will go back in and try to refinance and go back and get additional tax credits.
Mm.
That's how they'll traditionally do it. But not on the mixed income property. They, you know, unless they're, like I said, unless they're getting some kind of influx of cash from some type of dealer that they've done it, you know, no, I haven't seen it. Another way of doing it.
I think probably take away they have to add new affordable units. I mean, because again, you're trying to draw them in, right? You're trying to use the money up. So offer the money at the 3% interest, but I wouldn't say you have to add additional new affordable units. Just to see how the program goes.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe the next year you use it, you could probably add that.
I just don't understand, like, why someone would take out a $500,000 loan when, and they had to pay back $278,000 extra and then lose $336,000. I don't understand how the math works.
They probably would. Which is why I wanted to present it this way, because maybe what we do is that's a $778,000 loan on their books that they never have to pay. So we would just carry the loan, but we would forgive it and take the incentive of, you know what, instead of paying it back, restrict the units. So maybe those are the choices that we could provide. It could be a loan, no affordable units, you pay back $778,000, or you don't pay it back, and you get a reduction in revenue, but you're getting the money in today. The other thing I also want to point out is, remember, the money would go to the entire property. So it's not going in a specific unit. It's going to the property. So like there could be something like the garage gate could be broken, or there's a sidewalk that needs to be fixed, or there's a new roof. The money would go to address those things. It's not actually going into specific units. It's going to the capital needs of the entire project. Now, maybe there are some capital needs in specific units that are critical that have to be addressed, and those do get addressed, but it's not that those specific units that get whatever assistance related to fixing those issues are now restricted. The property as a whole, and they would take then the market rate units. And that's what they would then restrict if that's an option that they wanted to choose.
What if they sell the property before 15 years?
If they sell the property, they pay the loan back.
The whole loan and the interest.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you know they're going to do the work that's needed?
Is we usually hire a construction inspection company, and so they would have to review the draw. Similar to with our new construction, we have a third-party construction management company goes out and inspects the draws. The draws come in. I have to approve it. So they're not getting the funding up front. They're actually drawing it down.
Okay.
It's not like it goes into their own bank account. It's a loan. They're actually drawing it down from me, the bank, or the city is the bank.
So it might not directly impact the low-income units.
Correct. It may not.
That way. So mm-hmm. Is there a way, have you guys already, I don't know if this is or not, but... have you guys talked about if all or some of the funds can be the resources that go directly to tenants instead of the owners, like the low income tenants, where they might need temporary relocation, they might need environmental testing done, or legal help, or kind of more advocacy from the city?
Not under a rental rehab. So these are bond funds, and so there are specific things that the bond funds can be used for.
Mm-hmm.
Those type of tenant soft stuff, hard cost is what we would have. Has to be investment into the real estate property, not into an individual. It's 7 o'clock. You guys want to
know, right? We've already a lot of time. But all right. Thank you for the
information. Asking great questions. Okay. So again, it's information. This will come back. I just wanted to kind of get your guys' feedback as try to work on these guidelines. Okay. So item 6.2, very similar. This is called our multifamily essential rehab program. These funds would specifically be for 100% affordable housing projects, and I identified specifically what those are: Avalon Senior, Emory Villa Senior, Ambassador, Triangle, Bay Bridge, Estrella Vista. I can't imagine Estrella Vista would ever get funding. They were built in 2019. They're pretty new. All of the other projects are much older. So those would be the only ones that would be eligible. They also all have an existing loan with the city that helped create the affordable units there. The funding for this program would come from our community development block grant that we get from the county. We have approximately $80,000 in community development block grant funds that could go to support this project. The intention is that this becomes a reoccurring project. We get approximately $80,000 every year in CDBG funds, and we have been sitting on money because we fund Meals on Wheels. There's money that goes to there is a Healthy Homes Repair Program that we have that funds go to, and one other thing I can't think of. Oh, Healthy Home Repair, Fair Housing, and also the money goes to Meals on Wheels, which ends up leaving us with like $25,000 a year, which is a lot of money to do really anything. So we have a couple of years of funding. That's how we're getting to the 80,000. But the intention is to apply, to use that balance every year to continue to go into this pool so that it can provide capital funds to some of our affordable housing projects to address some small issues. So this could be going in and replacing everybody's carpet, or going in and, again, it could be fixing the roof or something. It's not intended to be that big rehab program. It's if you have an immediate need out there that you need some money for, these funds would also serve as a grant. Again, eligible uses would be construction, architectural costs. If the work that they're doing in that unit would require the tenant to be relocated, it could pay for the relocation assistance. It could pay for a capital needs assessment and reserve study if their one they have is outdated. And then, of course, we would also be able to cover some project and construction management costs. It would be capped at 15%. Their programs requirement, these all specifically come from the CDBG regulations. I don't have an ability to change these. So there would be income and rent restrictions. All the units would have to be rented to households below 80% of AMI with an annual review of the rent and income requirements. There's an environmental review process that we would have to undertake. The project was built prior to 1978. Which none of those are. They would have to comply with lead-based paint. There would be a 5-year maintenance agreement related to the property. They'd have to have property insurance. They'd have to comply with Davis-Bacon labor standards. That's only applicable for projects that have 7 or more units. One of the projects on the list has 6, so they would not. And if there's $2,000 or more in construction work, then they'd have, which is a very similar to prevailing wages. And again, the contractor has to be licensed, bonded, and not be on the federal debarred list. Financing terms, it would be a deferred forgivable loan. It would really be a grant for a 5-year term. If for whatever reason the tenants weren't income eligible, and again, these are already 100% affordable housing, so they're already submitting compliance reports to the state. And
so these are existing.
These are existing properties. So that should never be an issue. 0% interest, because again, it would be a forgivable grant. But if something happened within those 5 years to where they did something that would bring the loan into default, then they would have to pay the money back. Again, they'll also have to record either a loan grant agreement, deed of trust, and promissory note. With these funds, because we've been sitting on these for quite a while and I need to try to figure out how to spend them. So we would, for this one, because we have a very small pool of projects that would be eligible, we would do a request for a letter of interest, asking them who has interest. I actually already have a project that has been asking me for money. They need $50,000. And so this could be a perfect match for that. But I don't want to just give it to them. I want to put it out to the pool. The reality is this entity has 3 projects on the list, so they probably would be the one who would get it, but I want to make sure that I'm asking all of them to look at all their projects. So we do a request for a letter of interest to those projects. They would have to submit us a response back letting us know, do they have an interest in the funding? We would request additional information to understand their capital needs assessment or physical needs report to understand what those concerns are. We would then evaluate that and then hopefully award the funding out by April. This is an estimated schedule. It's extremely aggressive. I create schedules and I realize this, I do this to myself, assuming I have no other work. This would be very, very possible if I had no other work. But I'm gonna put it out there anyway. I have a goal to work towards. But this is what we would attempt to do with these funds. You guys have any questions on this one?
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Analysis of impediments of fair housing. So Alameda County did form this collaboration with all of the cities and housing authorities in the county in order to do the analysis of impediments for fair housing. So everybody's not paying to do their own. It is a requirement within the federal government. It also is a requirement in California through the housing element to do this analysis of impediments of fair housing. HUD, through the change in presidential administrations, has changed the requirements, but California adopted the requirement. So irregardless of what has happened with HUD, all the federal funding usually has this requirement built into it. Sometimes they change what that analysis needs to look like. The state of California requires us all to do it anyway. So that's why we've all done it. What it does is it's an overview of all the laws and regulations and possible obstacles that may affect an individual or a household in accessing private and public housing in the jurisdiction. So when we're doing affirmatively furthering fair housing, it's about looking at what meaningful actions are we all taking to address discrimination or to overcome patterns of segregation that have existed in the region. What are we doing to create inclusive communities that remove barriers to restrict people from those communities? What are we doing to address significant disparities in our housing needs? So this huge assessment was done. I have the link. I will send everybody these presentation, the slides at the tomorrow, Friday, so I'm not here tomorrow. I'll send everybody, but it's on our website. You could look at the entire report. It's probably like 200 pages, tons of charts, tons of information, but it is for the entire county. There are some pieces of information that is available on a city by city basis. There's also things available in the sub-regional market. So like we're usually considered a part of the North County. So Albany, Berkeley, and Emeryville are usually grouped together. Sometimes Oakland is included with us. Usually the mid-county is Piedmont, Oakland, Alameda, San Leandro, Hayward, and then South County, and then we have East County. So that's, but there are sub-regions that way as well.
We'll get that, you said, report.
Yeah, I'll send you guys the link so you guys can see the entire report.
How did they collect the impediments? Like where did these, I saw them at the top, like it listed what it was, and then where did they come from? Like
all the data?
Yeah, like how did they gather that? They asked tenants or?
It comes from a variety of sources. So there were a series of community meetings. So let me back up a little bit. So the requirement is that it's done every 5 years. The county took the lead. There's a contribution that we all play. Pay towards it, but they did a series of community meetings throughout the entire county. Different jurisdictions hosted those meetings. Not every jurisdiction, because there just isn't the bandwidth to do that. There's a consultant that's hired that does this across the nation. And so they did a survey, they had the community meetings, they go and do interviews with housing advisors, housing organizations, advocacy groups. There's a long, long, long listing of entities that they reach out to: disabled community, homeless community, healthcare agencies, education. Like they reach out to all these different people to gather information. Mm-hmm. And then there's also data that's just publicly available, census data. There's data that was provided to all of the jurisdictions when we had to do our housing element. So that kind of like demographic and resource information is all in there. They take all of that. And then they'll analyze what was in the last report and what did cities do, and then identify what are their current issues. What I will say is there are a lot of times are repetitivenesses of issues. So the impediments are the issues. So like there's in this current plan, I believe there's a total of 9 impediments that are identified. We all collectively, the consortium agreed to come up with 5 goals. And then there were a series of actions, and everybody was asked to identify what actions can you specifically take to help address these impediments. You're not required to do all of them. Like, there could have been 25 actions, but everybody needed to identify something within the five goals. So what I have here is what we committed to for the city of Emeryville. So for the impediment of discrimination barriers to prevent tenants from accessing housing, it's been identified that residents, homebuyers, and property owners have insufficient understanding of fair housing requirements and protections. Systems feel disjointed and hard to navigate for people seeking affordable housing, and that there's significant housing challenges that require coordinated approaches to meeting the needs of the community. So that's the overall impediment for goal one, which is to promote fair housing enforcement and education through an interagency collaboration.
Can you talk about the utility allowance worksheet, which was just to address action 1B?
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
So we've had a lot of questions that have come up over the past year. We do, through Hello Housing, they meet with all the property owners through collecting information for the annual reports, or when information and concerns come up, they'll reach out, ask questions. And we recognize, because there's been so much turnover in the property management staff, and we've just been getting more and more questions from tenants, created a fact sheet to help explain what a utility allowance is and what it isn't. And so that fact sheet, there's one created specifically for property owners to help them better understand it, and one for tenants. And that's on our website. So that's one of that education, making sure people are aware and clear. A lot of questions we get is the assumption that the utility allowance has to do with what they actually pay in utility, and it just doesn't. But that's a misconception that's out there. So it's just trying to educate. We're trying to do more fact sheets, more information to increase the education that's out there, so that people are more aware of what things are and what things aren't, and so that they have that information. So for this impediment, there are three actions that we agreed to. I'm providing you guys with an update. There actually is an annual report that is submitted to HUD every year. So this update is not what I submitted when they did the report back in April, but I wanted to give you guys a more recent update. And a lot of this information will also be integrated into our housing element when there are fair housing or accessibility issues, discrimination issues related to programs. So we did do that worksheet for tenants to address that issue. We have been marketing Echo Housing's fair housing trainings on our city's website and the housing portal. There's one coming up on the 17th. We've also asked our landlords to modify their marketing plans. So how are they reaching out to people to notify them when there's an affordable housing unit that's available? Those plans are required in our regulatory agreements to be updated every 5 years. A lot of them hadn't been updated in a long time, so we've been reaching out to them over the past 2 years, getting them to update that. And then, of course, not only does the city of Emeryville contract with Echo Housing, but the county contracts with them as well. The city's contract specifically that we pay for is for tenant and landlord mediation and enforcement of our eviction ordinance. What the county contracts with them to do is housing discrimination, and also a portion of tenant landlord concerns and issues. So there's two contracts that Echo has, but any question that comes in regarding fair housing, regarding an issue somebody has with their landlord, regarding concerns about eviction, those are all automatically sent over to Echo Housing, and their staff will work with that tenant in order to answer their questions, provide them with other resources. They are not attorneys, so they are not the ones who go with tenants if they're being evicted. There's a listing of eviction support firms that they can connect them with, but they're the ones who are providing that advocacy and education.
So going back to the utility allowance worksheet,
mm-hmm.
and I say this not as, you know, be offensive to all this, but it seems pretty weak considering that the action is coordinate with other jurisdictions on the creation of tenant advocacy materials that will provide easy to understand summaries of tenant rights and information or resources that can help with housing challenges, including where to find housing system, where to report housing concerns. I don't know if this is actually the cure.
It's not intended. So
got it. Okay.
This is a 5-year plan.
Got it.
we're not solving these issues, and these issues aren't going to go away.
Got it.
These are the things that we're doing that fall within that bucket. Okay. So what have we done so far this year? This is something that we have done in Emeryville.
Mm-hmm.
The coordination with the other jurisdictions to creating those things, that hasn't taken place yet.
Got it. Okay.
So there's nothing for me to report related to that coordinated because it just hasn't occurred yet.
Okay.
But this is what I have done to try to make sure that there's more education out there available for Emeryville residents on our website. And so that's what I had to, that's what I reported out on.
Okay. Yeah. So to follow up, so as we're like been talking a lot about the tenant right to organize and that sort of stuff, that would fall under, it sounds like that would fall under that, this kind of, that would be a remedy that would fall under action when
1B.
Yeah. Because utility allowance worksheet, I mean, it is something, but it's literally like just like someone walking to a restaurant and saying, well, here's the menu. The price doesn't change, but here's the menu. That's not exactly, you know, empowering someone with terms of rights to that sort of thing. And if it was like,
hey, this is a broad group.
Gotcha.
And so what you're saying is correct.
Yeah.
Okay. That work is underway.
Okay.
But it's not complete.
But it's not complete.
I don't have anything
exactly to
report because it's not complete.
Okay. Thank
you. So what have we done? This is what we've done because all that other work is being done by the consultant. And so that'll be something that can get reported next year.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, I'd rather report something than nothing.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. You don't want
to. So like,
want this
as I'm light. Working towards the housing element annual report that's that I have to get to you guys in February, every couple of months need to start thinking, what on these 46 projects have I worked on? Because I got to give an update on every single one.
Oh, no, I feel you. Because it feels like a filler, right? It feels like, I feel
so
you.
So what if this is something? Is it solving it? No. But this is something.
I agree. Yeah, I feel you.
Yes.
No, I get you. I got you.
Question. So it's not posted on the website yet.
Oh, no, it's there.
Oh, it is.
Mm-hmm. It's been there since the website switched over in August.
Okay. So this little one that says upon completion, it will be posted on the city's website.
Which one?
In the last column for 1B.
Oh, a fact sheet on 2025 housing laws has been drafted, but it's under review. That has not been posted yet.
Okay, so when that's completed, it will be posted, and then I'm sure there will be some kind of notice for people.
It actually is on your guys' future agenda item to bring to you guys some of the new laws. But the fact sheets will,
Okay. And then the other part in the first column where it says where to report housing concerns, do you know if that has been updated on the website or that's part of what the consultant?
You said
1B, it says where to report housing concerns.
Where to report housing
assistance and where to report housing concerns.
Would be. Oh, that's on our website too.
Currently.
It says where to report housing.
I have a really hard time finding that.
On the new website or the old?
When was it updated?
In August.
The date.
I actually walked through the website with the committee at the last meeting. Where things are located.
Do you or do you get any thought on how that's composed?
Website.
Yeah.
There was a survey that was issued about the website. Right past the elevator, you'll see the cone.
Okay,
and there's no lock on the doors, so you're not necessarily going to get. There's always, if there's information or something you don't like, you can always email me or tell me, or I think there's probably something still on the website that shows you. Let me walk through the website and do another time since we are. Okay, so real quick, So under number two, address challenges of displacement amongst residents in high cost and gentrifying areas. The impediments were increasing rent costs or pushing residents out of communities where they wish to live. And property turnover is resulting in displacement of tenants and high cost of housing, leaving few options for those. There were four actions that I identified that Emeryville could participate in. So encouraging landlords in high resource areas to market their available housing choice vouchers. We actually don't have a high resource area in Emeryville, But even though we don't have that, it's in our housing element trying to increase the utilization of Section 8 vouchers. So that's why I identified that. But no action has taken place this past year related to that. 2B is to work to connect tenants at risk of eviction or displacement with services that stabilize housing. We are in the process of modifying our tenant landlord relations ordinance. One of the requests that came from council, from the budget advisory committee, budget and governance committee, was to include in the requirement that there is a fact sheet of tenant resources that's provided when someone does get that notice. So that's one of the things that when we update the ordinance that will most likely be included, assuming the entire council agrees to that. Under 2C, monitoring the status of our at-risk units. We haven't taken any action. We have two properties that are scheduled to lose their affordability restrictions because their time frame has will expire by 2030. One of them is a housing authority project, and that's the one I think that happens next year. I'm not worried about that project becoming market rate because it's owned by the housing authority. The other one doesn't convert, I think, until 2028, so we have some more time before we have to do any actions related to that project. And then the last one is to provide home repair assistance to income qualified homeowners to allow homeowners to maintain their housing. There's funding, as I mentioned before, that's already provided by the county for all of the urban county jurisdictions, Emeryville, Albany, Newark, Dublin, and Piedmont, specifically to provide home repair to low-income homeowners. The city also contracts with Rebuilding Together North East Bay to also provide limited repair services to Emeryville homeowners. So those programs are already ongoing. Number three, the goal is to continue to support the creation of new affordable housing opportunities. The impediment was the region lacks the number of affordable housing units to meet the bands of low and moderate income households. Increasing rent costs are pushing residents out of their communities, and property turnover. Similar impediments, but this falls under this goal. We have three actions that we agreed to. So one, to continue to encourage construction of affordable housing throughout the region. That is something we're definitely, Emeryville is very focused on trying to produce affordable housing. We have in our housing element program G, which is actually one of the items further down on the list, our housing, city invested housing report. When we have city owned land, we have put it out for affordable housing. We have sites that are dedicated to do that. We're going to continue to try to make sure that we can produce affordable housing, even if a developer doesn't come here wanting to do it, that we can do it with our own property. So 4300 San Pablo is one example of that. And then the other one is the Christie Avenue sites. Let's see, 3B is encourage construction of accessory dwelling units. The city has modified all of our accessory dwelling unit regulations to comply with state law. We will do another update because every year there's new sets of laws that are implemented that we have to change our ordinances related to. We're also in the process of updating our website to create a subpage specifically about about accessory dwelling units. So that's in process. So it can educate people about how you could create one, what the requirements are, what resources are out there. And so hopefully that'll go live in early 2026. And then one of the items that is in our housing element and is also a part of our pro housing designation was trying to create a financial incentive for accessory dwelling units. So we have not worked on creating that program yet. That's something that probably we won't get to until 27, 28. But that'll be at some point something that we'll also use to encourage accessory dwelling units. And then 3C, increase housing density consistent with state law. We currently have our affordable housing program, which is a part of our planning regulations. We actually have hired a consultant, I think it was back in July or August, that's going to do an inclusionary housing study and also an impact fee review to figure out what changes we need to make to our planning regulations to increase affordable housing development. So that study will take about 2 years to be completed. The results of this information will not only go to Planning Commission, but will also come back to this committee as well. So over the next 2 years, information will come out based on the different components of that report. At the end of the 2 years, which is their time frame for completing all the work, they will come up with a series of recommendations to our planning regulations to change what our requirements are related to affordable housing. When somebody's looking for a density bonus or they're just coming to build here in Emeryville. Goal four is expand housing opportunities for people with special needs. It says the region lacks accessible units and supportive housing needs, housing units needed to meet the demand of special needs accommodations, and increasing rents again have a disparate impact on special need households that tend to have fixed incomes and fewer options for housing that accommodates their needs. And then there are also discriminatory barriers that can prevent tenants from accessing. We have three actions here. Provide accessibility improvements. We did that earlier this year. Last year, we launched our Emeryville Accessible Improvement Program. We actually only serviced three homeowners, one multifamily project, and one no HOA who wanted to do accessibility improvements to their program. That funding came from our Pro Housing Grant. Those funds have all been expended, and all work was completed this summer. 4B is facilitate housing development and assistance programs for special needs tenants. So we have quite a few programs within our housing element that ties back to that. 4300 San Pablo, those units are set aside for seniors and transitional age youth